What is junk? What is junk?
What are people?
What are people? Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
What is a Fred Williams?
What are speakers?
Fred, we've been laughing about famous scientists and infamous evolutionists who, when you talk to them, they pretend that they've never heard of simple concepts that we all speak about all the time.
Yeah, when we debate them on evolution versus creation, they do these things. What are people? Dr. Krause in the interview you just aired, I think, a week ago.
Yeah. What is evolution? You know, what are aliens? The whole thing, it's so funny. So I'd like to play a clip of audio for you. It's only 5 seconds long, but it's way back in the Bob Enyart Live archives.
Okay.
And I'd like to know if you can identify this. 5 seconds.
Oh, sounds like fun. Okay. Is this from like the TV days?
Yeah. Bob Enyart Live. Okay. Televised classics, which are available to this very day by DVD subscription. And boy, are they fun.
Oh, they are.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we're over the hump.
Oh, that's an easy one, Bob.
Oh, yeah, really?
That's Eugenie Scott. I saw that show live on TV.
You remember her.
I do.
She's a famous,
evolutionary scientist for evolution. Yes.
Anti-creationist.
Absolutely.
One of the most
time.
Famous in the world, anti-creationist.
And I saw you debate her on TV, and she said that in response, I believe, to your question, do we know everything we need to know about the DNA?
About junk DNA.
Because she was defending, I think, pseudogenes as not having function, and there's so much junk in the DNA.
Right.
And she said that, what she say there, that we're over the hump?
We're over the hump
of what we know.
We know everything we need to know to conclude affirmatively that all this is junk. And back then, they believed that about 3% of our DNA had function, and maybe the vast majority of it had no function.
Had no function.
It was junk.
Well, oops.
Oops. Because in a little bit, Fred, I'd like to play 6 minutes, multiple clips from that 1 hour show.
Great.
It'll be fun. But first, the journal Nature, that's the big evolutionary science journal in the world. Last month, huge landmark study.
Oh, yeah, this is awesome. There was 440 researchers have been working on this project, and they've identified 80% of the genome as being functional.
80%,
Fred. Oops.
Oops. Sounds like we creationists and the intelligent design movement, to give them some kudos too, that we have been saying, and there I was back in 1998, saying, of course we're going to learn that there's way more function to our DNA. And these areas you say are not functional, it's probably because we're ignorant. Like they used to think the pineal gland had no function, and the laryngeal nerve, and the, what else?
Appendix.
The appendix of all things, and the tonsils, and the pituitary gland. They used to say that these things had no function. And those were easy things you could look at with your eyes and say, what does that do?
Yeah.
But
what are tonsils?
Yes. But when you get down into the DNA, it's so egotistical. And it was their bias against God as the designer that led them to say that most of this is junk, and it impeded science. Darwinism hindered science for decades in significant ways because there was a resistance to look at the junk, which wasn't junk. They didn't want to look at it. They thought it was junk.
Oh, it was a brazen assumption to assume that that stuff is junk when really there's so much to understand. We still have tons more to understand.
Yeah.
But we started getting kind of an idea that this stuff wasn't junk when they'd look at these sequences and see mutations in sequences that were supposedly junk, and yet they would cause diseases.
Disease, that's right. And so we've been pointing out those studies, and there have now been thousands of studies, without exaggeration. Thousands of papers have been published showing the function of areas that they thought were junk.
And when you learn that and learn that changes in the junk can cause disease, my thinking is, don't mess with my junk.
Right, that's right. So, Fred, it turns out that these 444 researchers, they were working out of 32 laboratories around the world. This is one of the most significant landmark studies in the history of science to come out. And it is confirming we, creationists, are celebrating.
Oh, absolutely.
God is our designer. And the evolutionist, the evolutionary evangelist.
Oh, they're squirming. I mean, I was reading Panda's Thumb. That's written by some evolutionist named, I think, Nick Mansky.
Yeah.
Have you seen that?
I read that article. I've been going around because it's fun to look at the different evolutionists and what they're saying about this landmark study. They don't like it.
Yeah, it's biased. And, you know, one guy said it was a very liberal interpretation. Again, let's emphasize 440 researchers across 32 labs.
Mm. Yeah, and so they're coming out, and not only are they saying we have now, it's 2012, we've now identified function for 80% of the genome. That's 3 billion base pairs of amino acids, sort of like 3 billion letters on the DNA instruction set in every cell in your body. That's 3 billion. So they're saying 80% of that we have identified function for, and one of the lead authors said, Fred, in an interview, he thinks the number is going to go to about 100%.
To 100%, yeah, because they know that they haven't looked at the whole picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's right. He was interviewed, and he said this thing's actually going to get up to 100%.
Mm, yeah, that,
surprise there.
Very exciting. So what I'd like to do is go back to 1998, and let's hear about 6 minutes of this interview with Eugenie Scott. She had just come off of a debate on evolution creation on PBS, nationwide televised debate. And so I had a chance to talk with her. Went very well. We sell the DVD.
Yeah, and I have a feeling she doesn't, right?
I don't think.
So the DVD is Bob Debates an Evolutionist on Junk DNA.
That's right. And it's a lot of fun. And if you subscribe to our topical DVDs, one fine day, you'll go out to your mailbox, open it up, get a DVD, and it'll be Bob Debates an Evolutionist.
There you go.
Physical anthropologist, Dr. Eugenie Scott.
You know, I think when these evolutionist scientists debate you, Bob, they're thinking ahead of time, well, this is going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah.
They're thinking of some hick that doesn't know anything.
He's Bible just a thumper, Bible which thumping. I am.
Yes.
And just fundamentalist pastor, which I am.
Yeah. Just guy on TV and just going to slaughter him.
Yeah.
Well,
they don't prepare.
They're pretty surprised at how well you know this topic.
Well, it's a lot of fun. And so we'll play this. And just to describe it a bit, Fred, we take an hour and we get it down to 6 minutes. And, you know, conversations, they don't always go the way you want to. So a couple times we're going to or we're coming from a commercial break and the conversation never quite ends. We get to a different topic. But you certainly get the thrust of my argument and Eugenie Scott's argument in this clip.
Well, one of the things I remember was you had asked her to give you three evidences for evolution, and it just seemed like the show went on forever without her giving you that evidence.
For a half hour. It's typical. What do you mean?
Yeah, what, evidence. What is evidence?
What is evidence? And then I quote an evolutionist who wrote an article in an encyclopedia saying that we're lacking the fossil evidence of evolution of mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that it's a real problem. And she said, what does that mean, problem? What is this?
What is problem?
What are the, what is this people you speak of? Fred, why do they, what do they think we're speaking Swahili or Bali Bali? What is this ting tang walla walla bing bang you speak of? I mean.
Well, they can't argue the evidence, so they obfuscate like this. That's the way I look at it.
They
it
have
happens
this
all
quirk,
the time.
This quirk, right? And we have a nice list growing at RealScienceFriday.com of all examples of evolutionists pretending like they don't know what you're talking about. So, okay, toward the end, I mentioned skeletons evolving. I sort of give this weird laugh. If people don't know what that sound is,
okay.
It's my laugh. So, all right, let's hit the tape. I'd like to welcome to the program the Executive Director of the National Center for Science Education. Welcome, Eugenie Scott.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing very well. And Eugenie, I appreciate you coming on the show. My advantage of hosting the show in this debate might be somewhat offset by your advantage of having a PhD in, I believe, physical. Could you begin, Eugenie, by letting us know what you believe are the three best evidences that show that new features have evolved in higher species?
I don't really know what you mean by the question, Bob. Actually, I want to finish off what I was starting to say when we had to break for that commercial. Was when we were talking about evidence for evolution versus evidence for special creation. And I wanted to ask you about something called pseudogenes, which are sections of genetic material that don't have any function. If they were turned on, they would just put out gibberish because they don't have any, they don't code for any real proteins or any enzymes or anything like that. Why is it that you find pseudogenes that have exactly the same sequence of amino acid bases in closely related forms, but you don't find them in distantly related forms?
Eugenie, it took scientists a century to figure out what some of the higher structures in the human anatomy do. What do they do? Like the pituitary gland. It's somewhat conceited of us to say we fully understand genetics and we know that this material has no function.
If we are clever enough to be able to sequence a protein so that we know the exact order of amino acids and we know exactly what that protein does, that protein is not doing something else. It's not our ignorance. It's the lack of willingness to admit that this is a non-functioning protein.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think on the subject of genetics and what different genes and bits of information in the DNA code for and what they do not code for, do you think we have most of that knowledge, or do you think we are still to gain most of the knowledge of understanding how genetics works?
There's a lot of knowledge that we still have, that we still are learning about all the time.
Right.
But that's irrelevant.
To
pseudogenes.
Eugenie, maybe we could set up a ground rule for every question of yours that I answer. Maybe you'd answer one of mine.
Still trying to answer your first one.
Eugenie, do you think we have most of the knowledge that there is to have, possess about genetics? Or do you think we're mostly still in the dark with the majority of the knowledge still to come?
Oh, I think we're over the hump.
Oh, you think
we
know more?
I think there's plenty more to
Eugenie?
Learn, but we got the basics.
Okay, Eugenie, this is what I want to do. I want to date this, 1998, May 5th. Eugenie Scott, a degreed scientist, has said... I'll state what my position is. Most of our learning on genetics is yet to come. And we are getting ahead of ourselves when we state that this part of this DNA chain is useless, it's meaningless. I'm saying that there is much to come that we don't know about yet, and in the future we'll find out all kinds of things about DNA that we've never known before. And so one of your big arguments you're presenting to the audience is that there's parts of the DNA chain that we don't know.
I'm not talking about silent regions that we don't know the function of. I agree with you completely. There's a lot to be learned.
Even the
parts that
we know the functions, we know some of the functions. Genes have all kinds of influences on different parts of the body that we're just learning about. Isn't that true?
Right, but if you've got 100 segments...
Hold on. David, we'll go back to Eugenie here. David Berlinski, writing in Commentary, September 1996, said, "No paleontologist writing in English, French, or German denies the gaps in the fossil graveyard where there should be intermediate forms. There is nothing whatsoever instead. It is a simple fact. Darwin's theory and the fossil record are in conflict." That's David Berlinski. Back to Eugenie. Eugenie, go ahead.
Well, I hate to say this, but I don't think David knows very much about the fossil record.
How about Alfred Fisher from Grolier's Encyclopedia I quoted in the last segment?
Beats me. I don't know Alfred Fisher. And well, I think, didn't you give a date of 1958 on that?
No, I gave a date of 1998. Grolier Encyclopedia, you have heard of that, right?
Yeah, but I don't know this guy Fisher.
Well, he was the evolutionist who did their article on fossils, and he said one of the most difficult problems has been the almost abrupt appearance of the major animal groups. This must reflect a sudden acquisition of skeletons by the various groups, in itself a problem.
Eugenie, what do you suppose he means by problem?
What he means by problem is that the fact that you have 32 orders of mammals that suddenly appear in the
fossil Wait a minute. 32 orders of mammals don't appear. I suspect he's probably talking about the Cambrian explosion.
Well, in fact, there are 32 orders of mammals. If not, you let the audience know where in the fossil record does it show the evolution by the fossils of mammals?
Or I have no idea what you're talking
suddenly?
About.
How many orders of mammals are there? Are there 32 or no?
Beats me.
Bob, I don't know what you're talking about.
No.
Bob?
No.
What is evidences, Bob? What's
Yeah. Alfred G. Fisher, who wrote the Grolier Encyclopedia entry on fossils, appears about 7,000 times in a Google search, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Invertebrate Fossils text, and on and on and on. So it's interesting, Fred, that we could quote leading evolutionists who give us the most wonderful summaries and assessments, like this Nature article, saying, look, we now know that most of the genome has functioned. And paleontologists like Stephen Jay Gould saying, look, there's missing transitions throughout the whole fossil record. And they say it, and Eugenie is an evangelist, so she can't admit it.
That's right.
But they admit it all the time.
Oh, yes. And, boy, I recommend that DVD, Bob. It's a full-hour show, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you get all the material. And I remember at the very end she starts talking about she's got to go take care of her cat or something.
Yeah, she has to take care of a cat.
It always seems like when you're winning the debate.
And she said, well, I don't debate. You were just on PBS, yeah. Eugenie. That's how you got on our radar. And I like the quote from Berlinski from 1996. He's in Ben Stein's movie Expelled. And so it's fun. Creationists have had a great time looking at, now he's not a creationist, but he's an anti-Darwinist. He's saying the genetic evidence, the fossil evidence, it's just not there to support Darwinism. This paper in Nature, Fred, does it make an argument? Does it show how all this function, or even some of it, does it show how it evolved?
Oh, that's a great point, Bob, because I noticed when I was reading this article that there's plenty of gratuitous references to evolution,
yeah,
like evolutionary this or that, but they don't ever use it as an explanation of why this has function.
Right.
It's like they've got to satisfy the editors of Nature or whatever to provide these gratuitous comments
right.
about evolution.
It's this obligatory nod to Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
Yep. Hi, Chuck. And then they go on with their findings. And a famous scientist, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, Philip Scale, has famously said that, and he published an article on this, and he said in an interview, he analyzed 100 years of Nobel Prizes in biology, and he said he could not find one paper that was based on a belief in Darwinism. Not one where if Darwinism was false, they would have had to change their methodology or they couldn't have discovered what they discovered. Not one, he said, in a century.
And are there any inventions that we have that are based off of belief in evolution?
Right. There are so many
evolutionary science?
Creationist scientists who made discoveries that have enabled entire realms of technology and hundreds of inventions. Charles Darwin didn't enable a single invention.
That's right. You know, I've had some guys on the internet argue that, hey, you know, you can use genetic algorithms, you know, these things that simulate evolution with, you know, selection of a random process, and you can develop things for engineering. I'm like, you know what? Come interview for my company or any other company, and we ask you a question, how would you to solve this problem? And you say you're going to use evolutionary natural selection
random
of
mutations.
Random changes to a design.
Right.
It'll be, okay, next interviewee, please.
Right. Exactly. So, Fred, I'd like to talk through this article in Nature. This is the ENCODE Project, an encyclopedia of DNA elements in the human genome. That's what ENCODE stands for, right?
That's right. Encyclopedia of DNA Elements.
All right. And so they said that they have been able to assign biochemical function for 80% of the genome. In particular, they were focusing on the areas outside of the well-studied protein coding regions.
Yeah. So the protein coding region is the region that is roughly 3% of the genome. And so they've known that for quite some time.
Yeah, decades.
Generally.
Right.
And so they assumed the remaining 97% was junk. Well, they wanted it to be.
97% or a lot of it.
Or a lot of it. That's right.
And they had two motivations for that. One is Haldane's dilemma. The other is a direct assault on God. They said if there was a God who designed our genome, he wouldn't have done it this way. He wouldn't have filled it with junk.
Yeah, so kind of the ID, the intelligent design argument in reverse.
That's right. They have no objection whatsoever to using an intelligent design argument. Mm-hmm. None whatsoever. They do it all the time. They're hypocrites.
Double standard.
When they criticize creationists for using an intelligent design argument, they use the exact same argument, only they conclude, they say, since 90-some percent of the genome is junk, that's evidence a designer would not have done that.
Yeah.
Well, if he could use the argument in the negative, then obviously he could use it in the positive.
That's right. So I'm curious. This one was the obvious one to me. I can't think of a second reason they'd use it.
Well, the second reason was Haldane's dilemma. Remember we did that with Walter Riemann.
Okay.
And the smaller the percentage of our DNA that is functional, that makes us who we are, then the fewer mutations have to become stabilized in the population in order to go from a chimp to a human.
Yeah, great point.
So if
it helps them, they think, in this evolution from this chimp-like creature
right.
to a human.
Right. So first of all, they said, look, 90-some, 95% or more of our DNA is junk. And secondly, we're about 99% the same as a chimp. Well, it turns out that 80% to 100% is not junk, and we're only 95.2% the same as a chimp. And those few extra percents, Fred, that means there's 150 million nucleotide pairs that need to mutate to go from a chimp to a human. 150 million. And that has to spread through the entire population, and it all has to happen in 5 million short years.
Yeah, and really, that's a short period of time for something like that. Can't happen.
You can only get a couple thousand changes in nucleotides from 5 million years ago, allegedly, till today.
Yeah.
Couple thousand, that's it.
Yeah, beneficial changes.
They need 150 million. It's not going to work. It puts Haldane's dilemma right smack dab in the middle of the evolutionist difficulties.
Yeah, and that's another problem. They tend to push to the side and ignore.
Yeah. And Walter Riemann has single-handedly brought that back into play as an issue.
And we just had a couple recent shows on that, and you can go to realsciencefriday.com and listen to that. It's archived.
Yeah, just
great shows
slash,
with Walter Riemann if you want to learn more about Haldane's dilemma.
You could do slash Haldane's dilemma, realsciencefriday.com slash Riemann, Walter Riemann, whatever you want. It's real easy to navigate. Okay, so Fred, let's talk about what a protein is and then the areas of the genome that they say are non-coding. Like, for example, there's non-coding RNA. And so a lot of the genome is that. But let's talk first about a protein so that the audience could figure out, all right, if we have 3 billion base pairs or letters on our DNA spiral staircase, 3 billion, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And that's a bunch of information. Well, about 3% of it makes protein. So what's a protein?
Well, a protein is basically a biochemical machine. It's kind of like hemoglobin in the blood is a protein, right?
That's a good example of one. It's a little machine.
My wife's always telling my daughter she needs to eat more like meat for protein. So, you know, we'll have a nice steak maybe this weekend on the grill, and we're going to be eating a lot of protein.
And when you do that, you're literally eating billions of proteins.
Billions, that's right.
Billions of proteins. And so a protein is, like you said, it's a machine. It's a three-dimensional biological machine, and the way it's shaped is very important. And the kinds of amino acids, there's 20 different amino acids that are used to make a protein. So the order of those acids and the way they're folded is very important.
Yeah, so a protein, I think, is an average of about 1,500 amino acids. So it's a lot of amino acids folded in a specific shape. And when they get folded into that shape, there's a quality control system that makes sure that if anything goes wrong, that protein gets discarded. It gets thrown out.
If it's poorly
folded.
How does
that evolve?
Right. If it's a prion, a poorly folded protein, then it gets recycled. And if there's materials that are supposed to form a protein and they're hanging around for a while and none of them have become a protein, then they're recycled.
There's like a timer.
There's
That's
a timer.
Right. It's amazing.
So there's this awesome quality control that God designed so that our bodies would tend to live and not die. Now, because of the fall, Adam and Eve rebelled against God. Sin and death, disease has all come in. Information entropy is tearing us apart, really.
Yeah, we are vegetarians at that time.
Yeah.
So maybe a good thing of the fall is we get to eat T-bone steaks now.
Yeah, that's true. Fred, let's give the audience a couple examples of proteins. Like there are structural proteins that make hair and nails, our tendons, cartilage in our nose.
Collagen?
Collagen and keratin.
Yeah.
So those are kinds of proteins. There are proteins that regulate blood sugar, for example.
Insulin?
Insulin. Great example. There are storage proteins. For example, to store iron in your spleen, you need ferritin. There are transport proteins like hemoglobin. What does hemoglobin do?
I wonder if it's storage and transport stuff.
It does both.
Probably does multiple things.
Right? It does both. It stores oxygen and it transports it through our blood supply. So it's really fun to realize that there are thousands of different kinds of proteins. They have functions. Some of them have multiple functions. And they're three-dimensional machines, and they have to be made. And so about 3% of our DNA is used as a primary information database to make proteins.
That's right. It specifies how to make a protein.
Yeah. Then there's the rest of the DNA. And now they believe there are 4 million regulatory units or segments of our DNA to regulate things going on in our bodies. There's, of course, the non-coding RNA, like transfer RNA, ribosomal RNA. Now, we only have about another minute. But, Fred, these are functions that are not proteins, but they're information ways of regulating how proteins and enzymes and how they're being used. What's going on?
Well, the RNA transcribes the DNA. So which came first, the RNA or the DNA? It's a chicken and egg problem. Both have to be together at the beginning. That boggles my mind how the RNA is transcribed in the DNA, yet the RNA will come along and transcribe the DNA.
Yeah, right.
It's amazing.
So there are so many of those kinds of chicken and egg problems. To have a single living cell, I mean, the simplest cell, remember we did that show? It took 128 computers to simulate the simplest known single-celled organism. And there are single-celled organisms that are way more complex than that one they simulated.
Yeah.
So the simplest life is so wildly sophisticated. And now it's good of nature and these 444, mostly evolutionists, to say, you know what, guys? It has function.
Yeah.
It's not junk.
We're over the hump, Bob.
What is this junk you speak of? Don't give me this junk, Fred.
Real Science Friday.
Can you help keep Bob Enyart on the air for another year? I know you can do it. Every subscription, we're giving away Bob's brand new video on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Have you ever wondered what happened to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Have you ever wondered why it is that God put that tree in the midst of the garden? I've wondered a lot of things about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And Bob's brand new video version of his insightful teaching on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is free for anyone who subscribes to any of our monthly subscriptions. Folks, I know you get a lot out of Bob Enyart Live, and it's time to pay a little bit forward. Help keep Bob Enyart Live on the air. Call us up or go to kgov.com, subscribe to one of Bob's monthly teaching series, or just make a donation, $5, $10, $5,000, $10,000. It's the Bob Enyart Telethon. We need your help to keep on the air. God bless you.
This is Bob Enyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.